President Obama is taking some time off with his family this week on Martha's Vineyard, as much as presidents can take time off. So how does the public view presidents and their vacations? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll discuss the past, present, and politics of presidential vacations with historian Thomas Schwartz of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Before that, our regular analyst, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, will be with us. He'll talk about some political developments in the news, including what to make of the potential Republican candidates gathering on the weekend here in Iowa, some 29 months before the 2016 caucuses. Join our discussion on this Politics Wednesday after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we have arrived once again on Politics Wednesday, and so glad to have you with us during this edition of River to River. Later in the hour, we want to talk about presidential vacations. President Obama, as I'm sure you've heard, is taking some time off with his family this week on Martha's Vineyard. Well, as much as presidents can take time off. So we want to talk about how the public views presidents and their vacations. Perhaps you have a question or a comment about presidential vacations. 1-866-780-9100. We'll address that a little bit later in the hour. Joining us a little later in the hour to help us do that, Thomas Schwartz. He's the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, a notable presidential historian, with some of his thoughts here. In the first half hour, throughout the entire hour, Dennis Goldford is with us, professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Dennis Goldford, welcome to you.
Flying solo today.
Flying solo for the first half hour.
That's right.
Well, I'm not chopped to whatever you say, right? We're together, right? We're buddies, right?
Okay. That's right.
But you're the one with the expertise, so we will say you are flying solo today. In just a moment, we want to talk. I'd like to get your views on this past weekend of politics in Iowa with a lot of the national spotlight showing on Iowa for 2016. But before we do that, Dennis, the worrying news out of Egypt, we heard at the top of the hour, the capital descending into a bloodbath today after security forces sending bulldozers into a protest camp set up by supporters of the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi. A month-long nationwide state of emergency declared, nighttime curfew imposed in some areas. At least 149 people killed, over 1,000 injured. It's a toll that looks certain to rise. And this crackdown by security forces bringing condemnation, as we heard in our news, Dennis, from the United States, the United Nations, and prompting the resignation of the interim government minister, Mohamed El-Baradei. What are your views on the U.S. dilemma in dealing with this widening bloodshed in Egypt, especially considering the fact that the U.S. has for many years given substantial aid to Egypt?
The dilemma is that this is the largest and probably most important country in the Arab world, certainly in the Middle East. And it's very important to U.S. vital interests. And at the same time, the U.S. can do very little in the circumstances to have any significant influence over the course of actions. During the Nasser era, some 50 years or so ago, basically Nasser supposedly was unaligned, but he got a lot of military support from the old Soviet bloc. And it was really only after the Yom Kippur War in October of 1973, and of course that followed the Six-Day War in 1967 when Israel occupied the Sinai and the West Bank and so forth. But after until 73 with Sadat and the Yom Kippur War, really it was the Soviets, especially through their military aid, that had a lot of influence on Egypt. But since Sadat, and of course before his assassination, and he was succeeded by Hosni Mubarak of recent fame or ill fame, U.S. established, as you said, Ben, many more ties with the Egyptian military. I believe when we talk about foreign aid, the two, at least until recently, at least the most recent time I looked at it, the two biggest recipients of U.S. foreign aid were Israel and Egypt. And on the Egyptian side, that was primarily military. Mm-hmm. Designed to maximize influence like that. But in the current circumstance, the Egyptian military has its own fish to fry. And while they're concerned about and want to hold on to U.S. military aid, and the U.S. does not want to surrender that leverage, which is why the administration has not officially called it a coup, which would require them to stop the military aid. The Egyptian military, like the other actors in the Egyptian difficulties now, will do what they think they need to do for their own interests and their own survival.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to our domestic politics. And Dennis, if you or other listeners to Iowa Public Radio thought Weekend in Politics Iowa looked and sounded more like you were caught in a time warp and it was already, let's say, 2015, not 2013, you weren't alone. This past weekend, potential Republican presidential candidates gathered here in Iowa at a gathering of social conservatives. And so did a prominent Democratic group in support of a female president, Dennis, one wild guess who that might be. We also learned that Vice President Joe Biden is headed to Iowa next month for Tom Harkin's annual steak fry. Now, no candidate has declared an intention to run, not even a soapbox for political speeches at this year's Iowa State Fair. And the date of Iowa's caucuses, far from being determined. But Dennis, can we say, though, that the 2016 campaign is well underway here in Iowa, at least?
Well, I normally say after any given presidential election, the day after Election Day is the unofficial start of the next Iowa caucus season. And we certainly have that in this particular context. President Obama thought that if he won a second term, that would, I think in his words, would cool some of the fever in Washington on the Republican side, which was a silly expectation because once he won re-election, he was officially a lame duck. And he didn't do a good job at controlling the agenda in his first term. He lost control of that in the sense of not being the person who, despite having the bully pulpit, he wasn't a commanding presence the way Ronald Reagan or Lyndon Johnson or even Bill Clinton was. He had lost control of the agenda by April of 2009 when the town meeting cycle began that became precursors for the Tea Party. And certainly the Republicans had a lot of self-examination, not always to the approval of different segments of the party after they lost an election they thought they'd win in 2012. But for many of them, that was just a speed bump on the road to the next election. And so we see it here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to have us listen to a few of the comments from some of the what we would, I guess, say potential Republican presidential candidates here in Iowa this past weekend and have you listen to those with us, Dennis, and comment on not only what they may be saying, but the role they may be playing in the coming months, nearly 30 months until 2016. Here's a Texas Senator Ted Cruz speaking in Ames this Saturday at the Family Leadership Summit.
Following the tragic shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama came out and said, not that we're going to go after violent criminals. And I think we should come down on violent criminals like a ton of bricks. But instead, President Obama used it as an excuse to try to go after the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. And Vice President Joe Biden, you know, the nice thing is you don't even need a punchline. You just say his name and people laugh. But Vice President Joe Biden had said some helpful advice. He said, if your house is ever attacked, just go outside the front door with a double-barreled shotgun and fire both barrels in the air. Which is very, very good advice. If it so happens you're being attacked by a flock of geese. You know, if that dispute were decided on Washington rules, the momentum behind the president's anti-Second Amendment proposals was unstoppable. And what happened again is the American people got engaged. The American people got involved. You know, I was proud to team up with Chuck Grassley, the elder statesman from Iowa. We introduced a bill that was called the Grassley-Cruz legislation. It was the law enforcement alternative that said, listen, let's go after violent criminals, but let's protect the Second Amendment. And what happened again was the American people rose up in overwhelming numbers and let their voices be heard to our elected officials. And when the vote came on the floor of the Senate, every single proposal of the president's that would have undermined the Second Amendment was voted down.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz speaking in Ames this past Saturday at the Family Leadership Summit. Newly elected junior senator from Texas, rising GOP star. Your thoughts on him and perhaps what he said there, Dennis Goldford.
Well, Ted Cruz is a very ambitious young man. He was actually not the preferred candidate of the Republican establishment to take that Senate seat, and he won it regardless with a lot of Republican support or Tea Party support in Texas. Typically, the Senate is a much more egalitarian institution than the House is. I mean, there's nothing lower than a freshman member of the House of Representatives. But the Senate, they consider themselves fairly much of a fairly reasonably an egalitarian institution. But still, there's always been an assumption that you spend some part, good part of your first term just being quiet and getting along and going along. Cruz has not done that. He's irritated several people in his own party. He's been called a wacko bird by John McCain. But he's very ambitious, very intelligent. Some people on even the Republican side consider him to be very arrogant. But clearly, he excites social conservatives and Tea Party members. And if he doesn't have his eye on the White House, then it's hard to figure out who does at this point.
Mm-hmm. Why would he be there otherwise?
Exactly. In terms of what he said, you know, when I hear speakers from the political parties, I think of – and we can remember we read about if we didn't participate ourselves in those old psychology lab experiments when they attach a wire or something to a rat's pleasure center, and if the rat will press on a certain lever, it'll stimulate that wire and stimulate this pleasure center. And for Democrats, that pleasure center is for somebody to talk about being pro-choice. And for the Republicans, that pleasure center, among others, is for somebody to defend the Second Amendment. So Cruz is out there just pressing on that lever, sending those jolts of stimulation to that particular Republican pleasure center.
Let's go to another person, another potential Republican candidate who was on hand in Ames, former Pennsylvania senator and 2012 Republican primary presidential candidate Rick Santorum. As a matter of fact, as it turned out, the winner of the 2012 Iowa caucuses by a few votes after a recount. Here he is speaking in Ames this past Saturday at that same Family Leadership Summit.
We need to be able to communicate to the folks who hold the jobs and tell them and put a platform together that focuses on them. Because you know what? Not everybody in America is a type A personality that works 80 hours a week to want to build a business and that money is everything to them. A lot of folks want to spend time with their family, work in the community groups, spend time at their church. And we as Republicans believe that's a good thing. But we don't talk about it, and we don't talk to them. So my challenge to the Republican Party is to take a page out of our book and start putting forth an agenda of ideas to raise up folks who want to vote for us. You saw from the last election, they didn't want to vote for President Obama. But at least he went out and talked to them. At least he went out and spoke about them. We didn't do that. We marginalized them. So first and foremost, we need to reject this idea that, well, if we just build the economy, all votes will rise and everybody will be fine. I don't know about you, but most people I know have holes in their boats. And when that tide rises, sometimes they don't rise, sometimes they sink. And we need to talk about people who have holes in their boats, because we all do.
Okay, Rick Santorum speaking in Ames this past Saturday. Dennis Goldford, thoughts on his viability in 2016, if that's what he's there for? Give us your thoughts.
Well, first of all, Santorum's constituency here in Iowa, to a great extent, is being tapped by Ted Cruz. So the biggest threat to Santorum in Iowa, should they both run, is that Cruz might seem like the newest flavor on the block, as opposed to somebody who's been there and done that and is more of an old shoe and more familiar. But that being said, Lots of times in politics, what's old becomes new again. Over 100 years ago, about 125 years ago, a fellow named William Graham Sumner wrote a small essay in which he talked about what he called the forgotten man, the forgotten American, the little guy with his wife and family. They go to work, they go to their church, they pay their taxes, but nobody ever seems to pay much attention to them. Ronald Reagan in his first inaugural hinted at that. Well, the Democrats under Roosevelt went after that sort of forgotten American. That's why he talked about a New Deal. And they look toward that forgotten American, which really translates nowadays into what we can call the white working class. But since the late 1960s, and think of All in the Family and Archie Bunker, the Republicans very much have gone after the white working class. When they've won presidential and other elections, they've done so with success with the white working class. Well, when Romney talked about the 47% and so forth, Romney sounded, accurately or not, but he gave the impression of being completely out of touch with the needs and concerns of the white working class. And so Santorum is saying that's who Republicans have got to get if they're going to have any chance of electoral success, particularly with the growth in Democratic support among young people. Women and minorities.
Mm-hmm. So that's what we heard when we said, I think his quote there was something like people didn't want to vote for President Obama, but there was nobody from our side out there talking to the common people. I don't know if he used the word common, of course.
Right. Well, he said not everybody's a type A personality, but yeah, it sounded as though everybody, Republicans are focusing on, as he said, these type A entrepreneurs who built businesses. And Santorum talked about the people who worked for these businesses, who got his paycheck on Friday. And in the words of, there was an Alan Jackson country song, it's very popular, it's called The Little Man. If you ever see the video and listen to the song, it's a very effective look at really this particular segment of American society. There was a term coined a few years ago, several years ago, called Sam's Club Republicans. And the writers, I think Ross Douhat, who writes for The Times, was one of the two writers, authors of the book, talked about the Republican need to focus on these folks who were just regular, everyday people that Republican focus on entrepreneurs and big business seemed to ignore.
Another guest at this gathering in Ames on Saturday, 2012 Republican primary presidential candidate, also entrepreneur, Donald Trump, speaking in Ames. And here's a bit of what he had to say.
We're losing jobs by the millions. We don't have jobs. We don't manufacture like we did. And if you look at China, if you look at what they do with Boeing, with Caterpillar, they take the secrets, they take the patents, they make you build plants over there. They don't want Caterpillar tractors built in Peoria. They don't want Caterpillar tractors built in the United States. They want to build over there. Well, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? It's no great secret. And if they're going to manipulate their currency and hurt us very badly, and this is, again, other countries also, why aren't we taxing them so that their product becomes more expensive? Now, what's going to happen is it'll never go into effect because they will stop manipulation so fast your head will spin. But they don't believe our leaders. They don't respect our leaders. And they don't think our leaders are very smart. It's a problem. It's a problem.
Donald Trump speaking in Ames this past Saturday. Dennis, what does Donald Trump represent in the GOP today going forward, his role?
Pure id. Pure id. In other words, Trump says things that, again, press that Republican pleasure center quite often. But if there's anybody who would seem not to connect with the everyday kind of average American that Santorum talked about, it would be Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know how many everyday Americans have their own TV show and have their own private jet and have their own major companies. Mitt Romney looked like your average Main Street greengrocer. Trump's out there. He gets some press time because, quite often, no offense, broadcast media like great sound bites and so forth. But when he goes back to the birther issue, you know, a lot of Republicans want to say there are good, solid reasons in their view to oppose President Obama and want to make sure Republicans are elected next time. But this wanders off the table into the fringes, and Trump plays in many cases to the fringes.
Dennis Goldford, before we take a break, I wanted to talk about the fact that Republicans weren't the only ones casting an eye to 2016 this past weekend in Iowa. Let's listen to this excerpt from Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. She's speaking at an Emily's List forum held in Des Moines on Friday, August 9th.
We have to have millions of people engaged and ready for what will be a pivotal race in American's history, And that is about getting everyone excited now about what I hope will be that moment in 2017 when we all get to say Madam President to Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill speaking in Iowa on August 9th. Dennis, describe the position you see Hillary Clinton in at the moment. She's been the front runner for the Democratic nomination before. We know that. It didn't work out so well because of a young junior senator from Illinois.
Well, I saw an interesting quote over the weekend or maybe a little later that if Hillary Clinton were such a great politician, she would already be finishing her second term. She, of course, is one of the main big names in the Democratic Party. In the 2004 or 2003 Jefferson Jackson Day dinner with that whole range of candidates with Gebhardt and Kerry and Howard Dean and so forth, she stole the show when she came out to speak. She was clearly here in Iowa the star, but that didn't get too far for her in Iowa. She campaigned then as the candidate of inevitability. Anytime somebody does that, I think that's a political death wish because you've got to have a message. And just as Republicans are prone to talk inside their own echo chamber and not reach people outside the confines of the true believers, Democrats, too, are prone to talk inside their own echo chamber. Believe me, again, if the swing vote in the presidential election is the white working class, the predominant issue for the white working class in America today in this economy with this job situation is not getting a woman president.
Mm-hmm.
That may be the predominant issue for certain segments of the Democratic Party, but that's their echo chamber.
Before we had to take a break, let me read this quote, a comment on this on Hillary Clinton from USA Today and have you quickly comment on it before we go to break. This is from USA Today within the last few days. Iowa Democrats are salivating for Hillary Rodham Clinton to run, but they harbor concerns she's not terribly fond of Iowa. Was she so stung by her third place finish in 2008 Iowa caucuses that if she decides to run for president in 2016, as many predict, she'll jump over Iowa, dedicate more time courting voters in other early states? After all, her husband Bill Clinton didn't compete in Iowa caucuses in 1992, proving a Democratic candidate can bypass the first in the nation vote and still win the White House. Iowa activists noted on Friday from USA Today. A response there in less than a minute, Dennis.
Right. You'd have to ask Hillary if she's angry with Iowa Democrats. But the bigger issue is this. As we know, the caucuses are all about expectations. Did you do better than expected or worse than expected, regardless of where you finish in the pecking order? Hillary, because of the dominant name and the background, there would have such high expectations to meet that the caucuses could be a no-win situation for her. If she meets the expectations, unless she simply blows away the field, people say, okay, she did what she was supposed to. The big story would be if she failed to meet expectations, if she didn't get over that 50% mark. So it's a flashing yellow light for her.
Dennis Goldford, please stay with us. We're enjoying your insights on this Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford of Drake University. When we come back, well, we all know President Obama taking some time off this week at Martha's Vineyard with his family, as much as presidents can take time off. We want to discuss the past, present, and politics of presidential vacations when we come back. Joining Dennis and me, Thomas Schwartz, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. That's when we continue. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. We're in midstream with Dennis Goldford, professor in the Department of politics and international relations at Drake University. Tomorrow on this program, let me mention before we continue, we spend half the show with a native Iowan who's made a tremendous difference in part of the world that most of us know little or nothing about. Dr. Daniel Murphy grew up in northwest Iowa in the town of Alton, and he is now founder and medical director of the Biro Pite Hospital in East Timor. It's an amazing story he has to tell of how he came to found that very important clinic there and the work that he's doing tomorrow on this program. Today on this program, politics, and this half hour, we want to concentrate on presidential vacations. What questions do you have about presidents and their vacations? We know President Obama is taking some time off with his family this week, vacationing on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. How does the public view presidents and their vacations? How do you view their vacations? What reservations, so to speak, do you have about presidential vacations? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us, along with Dennis Goldford, now Thomas Schwartz is the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, a noted presidential historian, and here to add a little bit depth, historical depth, on our presidential vacation talk. Thomas Schwartz, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
Let's talk a little bit, get your views on how the public feels about presidents vacationing.
Well, I think most public views presidents, the presidency as a full-time job, 24/7. And so typically when presidents do try to take vacations, there's always in the back of their minds this feeling that, well, they really should be in the office at the desk protecting the country. The fact of the matter is that for most of the modern presidency, the office has gone with them wherever they are. And so presidents really are never on vacation in the sense that they've left things behind. It's with them. And I think as modern science has shown, that that stress factor is not good. It leads to bad decision making, and it also has a physical wear and tear. And I think anyone who looks at pictures of President Obama or any of the President Bush, when they enter the office and then when they enter the second term, you could really see the wear and tear it's taken. They're grayer. There are lines in their face. The stress of the job is incredible. Mm-hmm. And so just to be able to try to dial that down a little bit for a few days or perhaps even for a week is really a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Has the president's job always been 24/7, had this much pressure? Can we look back to a time when a president really did put a, you know, out on vacation sign on the door, so to speak, and have quite a relaxing time?
Sure. I mean, if you look at the early presidents, John Adams, for example, is often criticized for leaving Washington for a period of 7-8 months. And being at his home in Massachusetts. Now, often these critics fail to note that his wife was ill, but also that because communications weren't instantaneous as they are today, presidents could do that. They could leave Washington. They could be on their home or their estate for periods of month at a time. Thomas Jefferson did it. He was gone for 4 months. James Madison did it as well. And there wasn't the urgency and the press of business that mm-hmm. required their physical presence to be there and to make decisions.
What about Iowa's the only native-born Iowa president?
Herbert Hoover?
Yes, sir.
Herbert Hoover, because of the Depression, came so quickly after he took office. He made a decision really not to take vacations. But what the legacy he left, I mean, he understood the need to get away, to get out of Washington, kind of how Washington staying in Washington, it has its downside and its toxic effects. And so he and his wife purchased land in the Shenandoah Mountain Range in Virginia. It's about 100 miles away from Washington, so if he needed to get back, he could. And out of pocket, bought the land and built 13 cabins and named it Camp Rapidan. And he would go there on weekends, and also heads of state, Ramsay MacDonald, for example, the Prime Minister of England, went out to Rapidan with him, and they helped successfully negotiate a naval reduction treaty. But Hoover, when he left office, turned Rapidan over to the government. Franklin Roosevelt went there, realized that his wheelchair couldn't navigate the footpaths in the mountains. And so he set up Camp Shangri-La in Maryland, which was more amenable to dealing with his wheelchair. Mm-hmm. Dwight Eisenhower renamed it after his grandson, David. And Camp David is typically now where presidents will take a weekend retreat as kind of just a quick getaway from Washington.
You are a noted Lincoln expert. I wonder, with all the upheaval in the mid-19th century during the American Civil War, could Abe Lincoln take any sort of vacation? Did he?
He rarely got out of Washington. When he did, it was for example, when he gave that little speech out at Gettysburg. But he also would go up to the hills outside of Washington and Maryland to a place called the Soldier's Home. And Riggs owned a house and a Riggs Bank, and then it was purchased by the government. And soldiers would go up there and convalesce. But there was also a cottage that the Buchanan used and that Lincoln used and later presidents used. It allowed Lincoln to get out of Washington, especially during the summer months. Washington had a series of canals that are no longer there. But they would just become infested with mosquitoes and dysentery and cholera would rip through the city. They lost their son, Willie, in February of 62, probably to cholera. And so he would always send his wife and his younger son, Tad, out of Washington for the summer months. And frequently, Mary would go to the beaches of New Jersey or else would go to New England, to some of the resorts in New England. Lincoln, however, could only go to the Soldier's Home. It was about 3 miles away. It was something that where he could ride out to in the evening and ride back into town in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it's now a National Historic Site, and people can go there. They've renovated the Soldier's Home to the appearance as it was in Lincoln's day.
Thomas Schwartz is presidential historian, director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, one of our guests, along with Dennis Goldford of Drake University this half hour, as we're taking part of this Politics Wednesday to discuss the politics of presidential vacations. So when we jump into more contemporary times, we have, well, Presidents Johnson and Reagan with ranches, very well known, that California ranch where Ronald Reagan would be chopping wood. George H.W. Bush, Kennebunkport, Maine. George W. Bush, that ranch in Crawfordsville, spent a lot of time there. President Obama, Hawaii, and now Martha's Vineyard. I wonder, Dennis Goldford, what you see as the key political aspects of presidential vacations in modern times?
Well, I think to some extent, when the president, as Mr. Schwartz says, it's certainly the case that the White House goes with him. Essentially, there's always the fellow who carries the football, the little container or whatever the device is that has all the nuclear codes. I would be shocked if the president, wherever he is in the country or in the world, did not receive his daily intelligence briefing. So as we've heard, this instantaneous communications, instantaneous events now require that the presidency be 24/7. But I think when the president takes a vacation, that to some extent, this is not the intention, but I think the effect is it sends a signal to the rest of the country that things are relatively normal. We're not in a crisis situation. So the fact that the president believes he can take a vacation is in some sense, I think, reassuring, even if at a subconscious level, to the American public.
Mm-hmm. On our Facebook page, we've also asked for your questions or comments about presidents and their vacations, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, where you can tweet us at IPR Talk. A couple of notable Facebook posts we have here from Joel. First, who is paying for the president's vacations? If I were in charge of this expense account, I'd cut back on the amount for summer vacations. Perhaps President Obama and his family should rent a cabin at one of the Jellystone Park campgrounds. It might cause headaches for the Secret Service personnel. It might disrupt the plans of those who have made reservations there, but I think the campground would be cheaper than Martha's Vineyard. Shelley on Facebook, the president could stop work tomorrow and not work until the end of his term and not equal the nearly 1,000 days George W. Bush took off. I wonder if you knew, either of you knew, let's go to you, Dennis Goldford, first of all, in comparison, modern presidents, are there some, can you as president just say, I'm going to take this much vacation and I'll do as much and whenever I want it?
Well, in principle, yeah. I mean, you you want to beware of any kind of bad publicity for
doing
no boss.
There's no boss to ask for time off.
Right, it's
what
just
I'm
the
saying.
American people.
Right.
And unless you're impeached and convicted, you're there. You know, you've got a certain amount of time in your job. You have a limited tenure, so to speak. But I think that I did see something a few years ago, and I can't recall what it was. Perhaps Mr. Schwartz does. A comparison of how much time presidents had taken in vacation.
Yeah.
And I know George W. Bush was way up there in the amount of time. I mean, with so many of our Washington politicians, it always cracks me up about how much they run against Washington and want to go away on vacation, but they race to get there.
Mm-hmm. Tom Schwartz, your reflections on comparisons between presidents and relative amounts of vacation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that there's necessarily a comparison to the amount of time they take and their performance. I mean, Jimmy Carter, for example, had 79 vacation days during his 4 years, which is probably the fewest on modern record. And yet, I think the public doesn't see his presidency as being that successful. By foregoing vacation days, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be more productive when you're in office. I think ultimately the question is, if a crisis should occur, do you cut your vacation short and do you show up?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the criticism of George W. Bush was that when Katrina hit, he didn't cut short his vacation and attend to business. And I think most President Obama certainly has learned from that, and he cut short his vacation in order to deal visit the Gulf. However, you know, both President Obama and President Bush went to Africa, and when you look at the costs of, or excuse me, President Clinton went to Africa. When you look at the cost for Clinton in 1998, that African trip cost $43 million, whereas the current trip of Obama, the 8-day trip, was $100 million. Much of that, though, also is that increased cost of protecting the president.
Okay.
And
one is post 9/11, one is pre 9/11.
Exactly. And so any time the president leaves Washington and goes someplace, there is a huge cost associated with that, because not only does the White House go with him, but all of that protection apparatus and the advance team for the Secret Service and military and all of that.
Thomas Schwartz, what about this idea that Dennis mentioned a couple minutes ago about the image, the projection that a president gives to his vacation, that everything's okay on the country, with the country? If the president can take a vacation, well, let's not worry. But there are times when presidents are on vacation when, of course, things are happening all the time. So it may be covering the fact that very important things undoubtedly are going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Reagan cut his vacation short after the Soviets shot down Korean Airlines flight 007 in 83. Clinton returned early from Martha's Vineyard in 1998 after missile strikes after Afghanistan and Sudan on terrorist bases. You had Clinton also cut short a vacation to Hawaii to inspect the Midwest flood damage in 93. The job requires the president to also be able to sympathize with the plight of ordinary Americans when things happen or when the national security is at interest is at stake. And so this is part of that public projection that a president has to portray in order to show that the country's safe, that all is well, or that they empathize with the disaster victims.
Dennis Goldberg, go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's symbolism, but in symbolism is important in politics. And you may say, well, it's just symbolism, but we know going as far back as Machiavelli in the early 16th century that in politics, appearances are reality. And the symbolic dimension of what the president does or doesn't do, does he care, does he seem to be attending to the job, or is he just off somewhere, this matters.
Mm-hmm. What about the activities that presidents choose on their vacation times? We have, of course, famously Ronald Reagan chopping wood in California, George W. Bush clearing weeds in the Crawfordsville Ranch, and now we see President Obama golfing. Are these, I wonder, to be cynical, are they shows or are they really things that undoubtedly these individuals enjoy? Dennis.
Well, Reagan may well have enjoyed chopping wood. I'm not sure if George W. liked clearing weeds or not. But again, it's part of the symbolism. They show that you're just a regular guy. Now, there are limits to that. On the one side, it was, I think, during the Republican convention in 2004, John Kerry was photographed or videoed out windsurfing. And it was a relatively expensive sport, something not open to the everyday average Joe Sixpack guy. So that hurt him. On the other hand, remember in the reaction against Nixon, Jimmy Carter made a big show out of carrying his own suit bag off of Air Force One. And people said, hey, come on now. He's the president of the U.S. He shouldn't be carrying his own luggage. Mm-hmm. So, again, the symbolism matters.
And also, when you bring up symbolism, of course, gun legislation being a big issue in our times, the free time for presidents and vice presidents, going hunting is a part of showing you're connected with common people if they're hunters, and then that tragedy, the problem with Dick Cheney accidentally shooting a friend while he was hunting, so that can go awry as well. You have, I think, Thomas Schwartz. Can you point to the history of presidents actually getting sick or shot on vacation?
Well. Warren G. Harding obviously died while kind of touring Alaska. He went back to San Francisco. And Calvin Coolidge was actually on vacation when he heard the news that he was president. He was at his home in Vermont. The farm didn't have electricity, and so his father, who was the notary public of the town, swore him in by kerosene lamp. Chester A. Arthur had Bright's disease, a disease of the kidney, and he would use vacations as a cover to actually go to recuperate from his illness. He went to Florida and actually, instead of getting better, got worse. But then did a several-month vacation out in Yellowstone along with members of his cabinet, including Robert Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's son, who was Secretary of War. And while he was out there, he got a peak in Wyoming named after him, Arthur's Peak. So oftentimes, vacations are used as cover for presidents to recuperate. Grover Cleveland is probably the most notable example of this. When he had cancer of the mouth and used a vacation to have surgery done, and actually it was done aboard a yacht to even further provide cover. And then he headed to Buzzards Bay in Massachusetts to recover. And so the vacation, in essence, was used as a way for him to have the surgery done without the public knowing.
Thomas Schwartz, thank you very much for your time this hour. Director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, giving us some reflections on presidential vacations. Thanks to you, Dennis Goldford of Drake University.
Always a pleasure, Ben.
And Thomas Schwartz, we want to mention at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, you have a special exhibit, the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. That's still going on until the end of October, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you for joining us once again. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. And we had help from Rob Dillard in Des Moines. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk show is Catherine Perkins, who happens to be sitting in for Charity Nebbe tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, a special show, Catherine.
We're going to do our annual Iowa State Fair show. So we'll be tromping around the fairgrounds, John Pemble and I, and you'll get to hear it all tomorrow on Talk of Iowa.
Do you have any sort of colors? These are always very fun shows.
They
you want to give us a little preview? What are you going to be eating? You're going to be eating something.
Well, you know what? We didn't do a lot of eating this time.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
We did visit a lot of different people. There's a blind painter that we'll talk to, and a sheep shearing contest, which was a lot of fun.
I bet it was. Thanks, Catherine. We'll look forward to that special edition of Talk of Iowa with Catherine Perkins tomorrow. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us tomorrow on this program. We'll talk with Dr. Daniel Murphy. He grew up in Northwest Iowa. Now he's the founder, medical director of the Biro Pete Hospital in East Timor. A fascinating story. Hope you'll tune in tomorrow on River to River. Thank you.